This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. When I asked Jesse Simpson to show me the impact of Seattle's planning process for where new homes and businesses will go over the next couple decades, he knew right where to take me.
So we are in Greenwood, which I think is a neighborhood where you can pretty clearly see the impact of big decisions around land use play out over time.
Jesse is the government and policy manager at the Housing Development Consortium. That's a nonprofit that represents affordable housing developers. And we met up to talk about Seattle's newest comprehensive plan. Every 10 years, the city drafts a roadmap that dictates how and where Seattle will grow. And Jesse says the Greenwood neighborhood is a perfect example of the way these comprehensive plans shape the space that we live in. We're standing on the corner of 85th and Greenwood. It's kind of like Greenwood's downtown, where two busy arterials meet. Along those roads are new 5- and 6-story buildings with apartments, as well as some historic older brick buildings.
So I brought us here because this is the kind of street where Seattle has channeled growth over the past 20, 30 years.
In 1994, Seattle designated the area around these busy roads as an urban village, one of the 24 areas around the city outside of the downtown core that could accommodate denser housing options like apartments, condos, and townhomes. Next, Jesse takes us just a few blocks away, outside the existing urban village boundaries, to a street with single-family homes, mostly 1920s craftsman bungalows. As you can hear, it's much quieter than that busy intersection.
This is a place where you can really see how the urban village strategy has concentrated new housing directly on the arterials and forced renters to effectively be a buffer against traffic noise.
Jesse explains that these two nearby streets look different because of conscious choices by city planners. And right now, for the first time in over a decade, the city could choose to do something new. The mayor's office earlier this month released this decade's draft plan, called the One Seattle Comprehensive Plan. By the end of the year, it'll go to city council for approval. Jesse says the stakes for the plan are enormous, especially when it comes to housing affordability. Over the last 10 years, over 80% of all new development has happened in these urban villages.
The decision was made to basically focus all of the growth into the existing commercial and multifamily cores to really create a walkable mixed-use center while, and this was their language, protecting the single-family neighborhoods from much change.
But it's been hard to build all the housing the city needs in these limited corridors.
At a basic level, we have a housing shortage, and we need more abundant housing to make it more affordable for everyone. We have not allowed housing growth to keep up with job growth over the past 2-3 decades. And the result is that newcomers coming in, people with more means are able to bid up the price of housing, and lower income people have been forced to bear the brunt of vast displacement pressures.
Now, we should note that the new comprehensive plan renames urban villages as urban centers. It also expands some of the footprints of existing centers, including here in Greenwood. And it adds a new designation, places where some new density is okay. Those are called neighborhood centers. And this new draft plan, it comes at an interesting time. This is the first comprehensive plan since the state legislature passed a pivotal new law, the Missing Middle Housing Bill, called HB 1110. It mandates cities of a certain size to allow quadplexes, and in some cases sixplexes, in single-family zoning areas, including outside of Seattle's urban centers. But critics like Jesse Simpson at the Housing Development Consortium don't think the Harrell administration's plan goes far enough. He's also skeptical about whether Seattle's implementation of the state mandate will actually lead to more density than under its current code.
Compared to the current accessory dwelling unit code, it doesn't actually allow for more square footage to be developed. So you're just allowing a developer to put in one additional home inside the existing allowable box. And so in practice, it's not a real sea change in terms of what can happen in Seattle's neighborhood residential areas.
The city says the plan will pave the way for at least 100,000 new housing units over the next 20 years, or 5,000 new homes per year. Jesse points out we're going to need more than that.
Since 2015, we've been producing somewhere between 7,000 and 12,000 homes per year, and even that level has been insufficient to keep up with job growth. And so laying out a vision for 20 years of growth that only is planning for 5,000 homes per year, it's setting us up for failure.
The plan is still in the draft phase, and the city says 100,000 units is only a baseline. Over the next 2 months, Seattle will hold open houses to discuss the draft. I spoke with Rico Kitting-Dongo, the director of Seattle's Department of Planning and Community Development, about how it will shape the city in the decades to come.
What we know is that we are a growing city. We continue to grow. We are almost 800,000 people today, and we know that given our projections that we will be over 1 million people within the next 20 years. What that means is we have to plan for that density and that growth. We're required to do that by the state and by the Puget Sound Regional Council. It's something that we would want to do regardless. What we want to do through this draft plan, through the upzone related to the plan, is to ensure that we can provide additional density across the city in an equitable way and make for opportunities for more diverse housing options, opportunities for people to have first-time home ownership, opportunities for legacy homeowners to build generational wealth, opportunities for renters to find a reasonable place to live in the city, and make for walkable communities. So being able to walk to school, walk to your grocery store, walk to a park, easily get to a transit stop, and get to your job.
Since 1994, the city has been focusing growth into what was formerly called urban villages. Now, under the new plan, they're renamed urban centers. Can you explain what is the urban center model and how do they change under this new plan?
So I hope that this does not sound wonky. So I will try to be straight ahead.
We're wading into city planning and urban development. Rico, we can't avoid the wonk. Lean into the wonk.
So in the new plan, there's actually three different types of centers. Regional centers, which is a designation with the Puget Sound Regional Council. Urban centers, which used to be called urban villages, as you mentioned, which there are 24 of them that we have across the city currently. And so we're maintaining them and potentially adding on to the current designations. And then neighborhood centers, which are a new place type that we are introducing as a concept to provide small nodes, particularly around pre-existing, what I call naturally occurring commercial areas in residential neighborhoods, that we want to provide small upzones, like 2 to 4 blocks around those commercial centers.
And what are the difference between neighborhood centers and urban centers? The neighborhood centers are smaller areas. They're brand new. What kind of development will they be offering versus the urban centers?
So regional centers, we have six of them currently, including downtown, university area, First Hill, Capitol Hill, Northgate. In this proposal, we are hoping to reclassify Ballard as a new regional center. Purely conceptual level, and I say this just as it relates to density, you would expect at a regional center, so think of downtown, as an area where you would expect to see multiple story towers, a 40-story tower that could be office, could be residential. You would expect in our urban villages that the scale development is more of what, as a former architect, we refer to as 5/2. So a 7-story building that's 2 stories of concrete at the base level and 5 stories of stick frame construction on top of that concrete podium. And then in our neighborhood centers, the smallest of those three areas of growth and density, what we see right now is generally 1 or 2 story commercial, where we want to support those existing commercial enclaves, you know, where you can go buy a cup of coffee, go to dinner, places where you can go for local services that are walkable to your home, small infill groceries, mom and pop groceries. We see that there's an opportunity with those neighborhood centers to go from 2 stories to 4 stories or even 6 stories in some locations. So we want to explore that as an idea as we go out into the 8 open houses that we'll be doing in each of our districts across the city, as well as one online virtual open house where we want to talk with people about all these ideas.
So just to give people examples so they can think in their head what an urban center versus a regional center versus a neighborhood center looks like, regional centers are those densest areas like downtown or the U District. Urban centers are places like Columbia City, Lake City, the central area. What are some examples of these new neighborhood centers?
Yes, so our neighborhood centers, the one that we've been referring to most popularly right now is Maple Leaf. You would just think of them as being areas of the city where right now you're walking through a normal, formerly single family residential neighborhood, and you come upon a 1-story storefront building where there's a retail establishment and another one where there's a restaurant. There's a whole bunch of those across the city where we're really excited about kind of capitalizing on those places that have naturally popped up as small commercial nodes.
You worked on racial equity analysis of urban villages, now urban centers, in 2021. And that analysis found that the urban village strategy left low-income BIPOC residents, quote, confined to certain sections of the city, competing for limited affordable housing opportunities. How does this new comprehensive plan address that issue?
By taking on the adoption of what was House Bill 1110, which is state legislation, which requires for all cities and counties that we are moving away from single family zoning and moving toward requiring a minimum of 4 units on any formerly single family lot or up to 6 units where adjacent to transit. What we are capitalizing on is that instead of having what today, you know, 75% of the landmass of the city of Seattle is single family zoning, which is not very dense. And as we continue to grow as a city, we are going to have to create infill housing opportunities within our historic neighborhoods that fit the height, bulk, and scale of our existing neighborhoods, but that provide for more families on sites that either currently or previously didn't afford the opportunity for more than one family to be on a site. Why is that important? Having four families on a site, four units on a site, means that the cost of any one of those units is less than the cost of one large single family residency on a site. One of the things that we've been talking about for areas like Rainier Valley, the Central District, areas of high displacement, also areas where communities have suffered from previous regressive land use policies and redlining. In doing this upzone, we're also hoping to create some policies around legacy homeowners. So BIPOC families that already own property in the Central District, in Rainier Valley, in White Center, that they are able to build an accessory dwelling unit, a detached accessory dwelling unit, two additional freestanding units on their property, build generational wealth, create a reverse mortgage situation that allows them to stay within the neighborhood that they are already a part of and not be forced out by predatory development practices when an upzone happens.
I'm talking with Rico Kitting-Dongo, the director of the Office of Planning and Community Development with the City of Seattle, about the new draft comprehensive plan that was released by the mayor's office last week. So you are bringing up this big statewide bill, Rico, that was passed by the legislature last year, and that's HB 1110, which requires cities to add more density into single-family zones. So quads in most part of most cities, if they're over something like 75,000 in population, and even sixplexes if there is affordable housing included in those developments. Why not allow, say, small courtyard apartments, things that, you know, are just a few stories, they have a residential feel, but they're a little denser than a quad or a sixplex, across the city of Seattle? What's the argument for maintaining the density growth really in these neighborhood centers and urban centers?
I think it's important to understand that growth should be accommodated as a transitional beast, which happens gradually over time. If we have 75% of our landmass single family residents today, what we're trying to do in implementing HB 1110 is create a gentle density opportunity. And I should remind listeners of this. Today, any single family lot in the city of Seattle can accommodate up to three families, a primary residence plus an accessory dwelling unit plus a detached accessory dwelling unit. So making the move from three units to four units per the state legislation isn't a big leap. What it does mean is that with the new legislation, those four units can all be independently owned. There's not a condominiumization that has to happen. You no longer have to hold to this designation of a primary residence. But by holding to the four-unit, six-unit mix for a large percentage of those formerly single-family neighborhoods, what it allows is the opportunity to create infill housing in formerly single-family neighborhoods that still fits the height, bulk, and scale of those historic neighborhoods, doesn't impose a undesirable scale for the people that already live in those neighborhoods, but does provide for greater density. I do understand that there's folks that want to see us do more than that. And that's where we are in this proposal suggesting greater density along transit corridors at transit-oriented development sites, which includes our bus rapid transit and Sound Transit light rail stations, plus this proposal to do higher density at 24 neighborhood center nodes across the city. So there are areas of the city that we do want to introduce greater levels of density, but we want to do it in with a measured approach and to do it surgically.
Rico Kitting-Dongo is the director of the Office of Planning and Community Development with the City of Seattle. Great thanks for your time today and walking us through the plans. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Really excited to get out and talk to people.
And before we go, let's head back real quick to Greenwood and Jesse Simpson from the Housing Development Consortium. Because something both Rico Kitting-Dongo and Jesse agree on is that Seattle needs more housing. Where they differ is where and how quickly that growth should happen. Jesse says there will always be concerns from residents and homeowners in single-family neighborhoods about change and maintaining a block's character. But for Jesse, the character of a place, it isn't in the buildings.
I think what really defines the character of Seattle's neighborhoods are the people who are able to live in them. If we follow the lead of San Francisco and freeze our neighborhoods in amber, we're just going to be pricing out ourselves or the people who are essential to the actual functioning of Seattle. So my response to a homeowner who's worried about change in their neighborhood, it's understandable at a human level, but I think we need to understand that change is going to happen. The question is the change that happens, the existing homes just get dramatically more expensive as they turn over, the only people able to afford to live in the city will be really well-paid tech workers or those with a ton of generational wealth. Or are we actually going to allow for more affordable housing options throughout the entire city? Are we going to create the kinds of apartments, condos, fourplexes that will allow people who are earning a more middle-class, working-class wage to live in the city?
The city will host open houses in all 7 Seattle City Council districts over the next few months, as well as a virtual open house to hear from residents about the plan. The next open house is on Tuesday, March 19th at Cleveland High School at 6 p.m. You can find more information by going to Seattle's Office of Planning and Community Development's website. And we are only scratching the surface of this plan. KUOW's podcast Booming will take a look at this subject on Wednesday's episode, specifically what it would take for Seattle to become what's called a 15-minute city. Thanks for listening to Soundside. This show is only possible because listeners support us. If you're able to give right now, please check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.